want to welcome you to part two, Behind the Bloodshed, How Zionism and Jihadism Differ. In this section, we're going to deal with the history of Israel, the attack of October the 7th, and what are the motivations behind Hamas and Israel. I'm Paul Johnson. I'm just a typical optimistic American who believes that the U.S. is a cause for good in the world. If you're interested in this discussion, go ahead and hit that subscribe button and let's get started.
Destiny. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. Destiny. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Now, again, before you invest your time in this, let me disclose some of my biases. Everyone has a bias. It's just that not everyone will admit to having a bias. While I'm an independent voter, I spent my life in politics, business, and I've been around the world studying genocides and major conflicts. I co-authored a book called Addictive Ideologies that focused on radical ideologies like we're talking about here. I have a bias against jihadism, for that matter, extremist factions even on the right and left in American politics. I'm biased in believing that they are very damaging to the values that we as Americans call truth. Additionally, I don't have any justification for a parent having to pull their two-year-old out of a heap of rubble. If you're appalled by the images that you're seeing on TV regarding the war in Gaza, you should be. We all should be appalled. All I can say about that is that in my study of war and genocide, one thing's universal: war is really bad. Now, I understand that you want a deeper answer or a justification, but as for me, I just don't have any good examples of war. What I can give you is a deeper look at the facts and questions that surround this war. Last, I see a large distinction between Muslims and jihadists. There are 2 billion Muslims on the planet, and I think we should create a big distinction between them and jihadists, as well as Muslims should try to separate themselves from the radical mindset of the jihadist. Most Muslim I know do. But let's start with the history of Israel. I'm going to avoid ancient history, although historians agree that Jerusalem was founded by Jewish kings. Certainly, they were conquered by the Assyrians and the Romans, and 1,600 years after its founding, it was conquered by Islam. Some might call that colonialization by Islamic warriors, but it doesn't matter, because they lost it to Crusaders, who a few hundred years later got it back. It was taken over by Ottomans, and then that was lost to the British. But during all this time, there were always Jewish people, although for large periods of time, it was abandoned by almost everyone. The historical narrative of Israel and its complex relationship with its neighbors and Palestinian territories is deeply rooted in a millennia of history. But I'm going to try and start with a focused examination with the pivotal year starting in 1948. 1948 marked a turning point in the aftermath of World War II and the Holocaust. Millions of Jews around the world were made homeless by the genocidal ideology of the Nazis. The world didn't want to have to deal with the question of these Jews going back into communities where their homes and properties had been taken from them during the Nazi occupation. They didn't want to restore their families to their rightful properties, and they needed a political solution that didn't disrupt the politics in their home country, but also dealt with the large amount of Israeli Jews who were without a home. Now, it's important to point out, this just wasn't in Europe where Jews' properties and homes were taken from them. As much as this is denied by jihadists in Palestine, they were especially displaced in Arab nations occupied by Nazis. When the Nazis were defeated and prosecuted for war crimes, it's often overlooked that anti-Semitism was at a feverish pitch in many Arab nations. This is just a historical fact. The Ba'ath Party was really just a fascist spin-off of the Nazi Party under a different name. In places like Iraq, under the banner of the Ba'ath Party, they tortured and murdered Jews even after the war in programs such as Farud. The question of Jews being displaced was a fact in Arab nations, but that didn't make giving them a home any less complex. The fall of the Ottoman Empire after World War I in 1917 led to a British mandate over much of its territories. Both Jews and Arabs occupied Judea and Palestine. Both wanted to call it a home. A compromise was developed, culminating in the United Nations Partition Plan in 1948. The plan proposed a separation of Jewish and Arab states. After this, Israel declared its independence. Jews would have a homeland. But this initiative was met by rejection by the Arab states, including Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, who all attacked Israel. They deeply resented the Jewish state in the Middle East. General Nasser in Egypt led the attack, who would later become the political leader of Egypt. Despite overwhelming odds, Israel emerged victorious, defining borders that excluded the West Bank from Israeli territory. Yet many Arabs within the new borders of Israel chose to stay, becoming full citizens and enjoying the right of citizenship today. However, the creation of Israel created a tide of anti-Semitism throughout the Arab world. The political movements of the Ba'ath Party, as well as other parties connected to the Nazi philosophy, began to fester in the Middle East. Mathis Kunzel's book, Jihadism and Jew Hatred, Islamism, Nazism, and the Roots of 9/11, argue that the main cause of Nasser's decision to threaten to destroy Israel in 1967 and the subsequent enthusiasm of his followers was an anti-Semitic impulse as it was carried over from the Nazi period. Nasser partly came from an office capitalizing on this tide of anti-Semitism. The actual cause of the 1967 war was that Israel made repeated declarations that the closure of the Straits of Tehran was an act of war. Israel's only access to the Red Sea was a seaport at Eilat that harbors at the Gulf of Aqaba. You can see this here on the map. Egypt's closing of the Strait of Tehran would close off Israel of necessary supplies and 90% of Israel's oil. Egypt blockaded the straits on May 27, 1967. Now, Egypt's later position became that Nasser received false reports from the Soviet Union that Israel was amassing on the Syrian border. They obviously weren't. It wouldn't be a surprise, though, if in fact they had been given false information. The Soviet Union in 1967, just as Russia and China understand in 2024, see the Arab and Israeli conflict as bad for the United States. Regardless, Nasser expelled the United Nations Emergency Peacekeeping Force, UNEF, from Gaza and Sinai on May 19th. He took over the UNEF positions overlooking the Straits of Tehran. Israel repeated declarations that closing the strait was tantamount to war, but Nasser closed the straits to Israel shipping on the 22nd through the 23rd of May, and Israel struck back. This led other Arab nations to attack Israel. In the writing of our book, Dr. Bashaw and I did significant interviews with people who lived through this period in 1947 and 1948 in Arab nations. One thing that was clear to us was the fervent anti-Semitism that existed throughout Arab nations and how it took place in programs. It's often overlooked by historians the effect of this anti-Semitism on Arab nations' political bodies. But certainly by 1960s, this was true in Egypt, where Nasser was gripped by the same destructive sentiments that he had whipped up in the masses for his political career. This anti-Semitism was resulting in Jews becoming refugees all over the Arab world, as seen in this chart. The closing of the strait was designed to suffocate Israel, and Nasser fed that anti-Semitism with the promise to push the Zionist out of the Middle East. His war on Israel was a way to deliver on his political promises. It is hard not to see how the 1967 Six-Day War, initiated by an Egyptian-led coalition, did not result in an Israeli defeat. Yet, Israeli strategic victory not only ensured its survival, but it also resulted in the capture of the West Bank and Gaza, territories that were previously controlled by Jordan and Egypt, respectively. The Israel victory caused embarrassment to the Arab world. That embarrassment would lead to radicals within the Arab countries trying to overthrow their existing orders with a more radical version of Islam, jihadism. Eventually, it would lead to political leaders feeling that they had to try again to overthrow Israel. Yasser Arafat's rise to the leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, marked a new phase in the conflict. Based initially out of Jordan, Arafat's tactic of disruption led to Black September, also known as the Jordanian Civil War between Palestinians, through which the PLO and Jordans entered into a civil war. This led him to going into exile from the expulsion by King Hussein, a progressive leader who focused on his country's prosperity and wanting to avoid war as opposed to provoking one. One of Arafat's tactics was an assassination attempt against King Hussein, which just really never goes over well with the king. The PLO was defeated and it was routed into Lebanon. Here, they'd do the same thing. They'd fuel further instability and they contributed to the Lebanese Civil War. In 1973, Israel was attacked in the Yom Kippur War again. Now, this war was caused in large part by the instability caused by the PLO in Arab countries, and Arab leaders were embarrassed by the loss of the 1967 war. This time, in a surprise attack on the holiday of Yom Kippur, Egypt and Syria attacked. Again, the odds were stacked against Israel's survival. But the result of the Yom Kippur War, almost miraculously, was that Israel won, and Arab leaders resigned to the idea that Israel was in the Middle East to stay. It also became clear that Arafat was stoking the flames of dissension far outside of Israel. Arafat, who had fled Jordan to Lebanon, and his activities there led to another civil war in Lebanon. The ongoing conflict saw significant escalation in 1982 when Israel invaded Lebanon in response to PLO aggression, leading to Arafat's exile to Tunisia. This period underscores the PLO's isolation as it critiqued both Israel and Arab nations for their lack of support. The political landscape shifted again in 1988 when the PLO and a Palestine National Council meeting in Algiers declared all of its West Bank and Gaza as the future Palestinian state. This was the first time that that was done, as well as claiming that they had the rights to all of Israel. This was significant because the PLO had failed in Lebanon, Egypt, and Jordan to create a Palestinian state. This was significant because it marked the PLO's failure in Lebanon, Egypt, and Jordan to create a Palestinian state. By declaring the West Bank and Gaza as the future Palestinian state, they could gain recognition by the Arab League, who wanted to get rid of them. The Palestinians would now be seen as an Israeli and American issue, and the emergence of Hamas from the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood further complicated the dynamics within the Palestinian politics. The early 1990s brought another turning point with Iraq's invasion of Kuwait on August 7, 1990. Was an action that terrified Arab states and exposed the fragility of regional alliances. Arafat surprised other Arab nations by actually supporting Saddam Hussein's radical ambitions. Now, this move alienated many, leading to a resentment of the Palestinian leadership strategies. Saddam and the Ba'ath Party had come to power in Arab states under the idea of a pan-Arab state whose rally cry was the eradication of Jews. Saddam's invasion was an indication to groups like Saudi Arabia that after Saddam got Kuwait, Saddam would come for them, utilizing anti-Semitism to stoke the fires in nations like theirs. This cemented the tacit support in Arab states that the West Bank would become homeland for Palestinians. They needed the support politically, and they needed to make it someone else's problem. This period of turmoil and shifting alliances paved the way for the Oslo Accords in 1993, a landmark in the peace process. While Arafat's reunification of the charter calling for Israel's destruction, it also created a pathway for a negotiated settlement for the West Bank as a home to the Palestinians. This was where the PLO was clear that their real goal was a single state, driving the Jews into the sea, while the PLO was clear that their real goal was a single state, driving the Jews into the sea. It illustrated a significant, albeit contested, potential for peace and coexistence, not unlike what the British and UN had proposed with the partition plan all the way back in 1948. But unfortunately, at the end of the process, Arafat and the PLO walked away with what would have been a two-state solution. The true story of Oslo at Camp David was for the first time in history of the conflict the American president, Bill Clinton, put on the table a proposal based on the U.S. Security Council Resolution 242 and 338, and it was very close to the Palestinian demands. And Arafat refused to even accept it as a basis for negotiation. He walked out of the room. The proposal included the establishment of a demilitarized Palestinian state. The settlements were to be dismantled. A Palestinian capital would be in East Jerusalem. Arab neighborhoods today in Israel proper were placed under the sovereign control of Palestine, and the international community was to give massive aid to facilitate refugee rehabilitation. Bill Clinton, you can hear him on podcast, say that he was stunned when they rejected the deal. He even forced them to listen to him read the document out loud slowly to make certain they understood. Arafat's goal seemed to be that he didn't really want a two-state solution, because what they really wanted was a one-state solution. And while he might agree to take what the Western world would give him, he wanted an agreement that would allow for him to come back and ask for more later. Whatever the goal, they walked from the deal that has literally almost a zero chance of ever being offered again. It set the stage for everything we see today in the conflict between the two people. Now then, in 2005, Israel walked away from occupying Gaza. Gaza elected a government, a representation of Hamas, a government whose governing documents inscribe exactly those sentiments of never reaching an agreement with Israel, of never agreeing to Jews having a homeland, of never being in the area they called Palestine. All right, so before we really dig in and examine Hamas, let me start with saying this again, and I know it's trite. War is bad. Again, I know that sounds so obvious, but I want to be clear that I don't see war through a set of rose-colored glasses. And I think far too often we apply standards to war that have nothing to do with war. I've studied them from afar and from close up. I just don't know of a good example of war. I said to you at the beginning, I don't have a defense for parents carrying their lifeless body of their child to a hospital looking for an answer. War is just what it is. A long time ago, Clausewitz said that war is politics by another means. War in the abstract has a sense of honor and glory tied to it. But in reality, when a side abandons the political process and decides to let the genie out of the bottle, what can result is uncontrollable horror. I think that the world was so lucky to defeat in the 1940s Germany and Japan. We almost didn't. Yet I don't have a defense for the brutality suffered by non-combatants in Berlin in 1944 or in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. I don't have one for the moms in Palestine. War is a horrible thing. But what's most shocking to me in this war? You know, usually wars are declared by attacking military targets. This one, the one on October 7th, resembles the one in Bosnia, started by an act of genocide by the Serbians. On October the 7th, a significant attack orchestrated by Hamas targeted Israel, marking it as one of the deadliest terrorist attacks in history since the beginning of data collection in the 1970s. This attack, unprecedented in its scale and fatalities, resulted in the death of approximately 1,400 Israelis, surpassing the fatality count of many previous attacks in Israel's history. The attack was characterized not only by its high casualty rate of innocent civilians, but also its utilization of sophisticated weaponry used by Hamas. The Israeli Defense Forces have identified a significant portion of the armaments used in the attack as being Iran-produced. Among those are 60-millimeter mortar rounds and demolition charges. These mortar rounds are a type of short-range indirect fire weapons capable of targeting a range of sites from border outposts to civilian homes. The demolition charges, known for their versatility and ability to be shaped to suit various purposes, were likely used to penetrate Israeli homes and bomb shelters, aiming to inflict maximum civilian casualties. Now, this attack represented a shift in the nature and scale of conflicts in the region. For Israel, this is a pivotal moment shaping the national consciousness around security and the ongoing conflict. Before this attack, this area faced regular missile attacks by Hamas, unprotected by the Iron Dome. Consequently, this area had bomb shelters built at regular spacing intervals. The people of this area are trained to get to a bomb shelter within 30 seconds. That's all the warning they'll have if Hamas launches a weapon. But the weaponry used and the tactics employed in this attack highlight the evolving nature of warfare and terrorist activities, raising questions about the future of regional stability and the global implications of such high casualty attacks. On October the 6th, just a day before the October 7th attack, this was a thriving agricultural community. It's nestled in the vast expanse of the Negev Desert, which is one of the oldest surfaces on the planet Earth. The Kfar Azah stands as a testament to human resilience and innovation. This kibbutz, established in 1951 by Jewish immigrants from Egypt and Morocco, is more than just a farming community. It's a beacon of agricultural ingenuity in one of the harshest environments on the earth. The kibbutz members that are dedicated to their land have transformed the challenging desert terrain into a flourishing agricultural hub, thanks in part to pioneering irrigation technologies. The Negev Desert, known for its ancient geological formations like the unique Makhentashim Crater, are the formations that are only found here. It is steeped in history in areas like the East Negev, where the world-renowned Dead Sea exists, and the ancient fortress of Masada. The Negev Desert features a diverse landscape, including rocky plateaus and deep canyons, high mountain ranges, and sand dunes. But here in this area near Gaza was where the innovation of the Jews took place in only a very sparse population. The farmers who live here, they kind of remind you of the hippies of the U.S. They're liberal peaceniks dedicated to the land, struggling to survive and make ends meet. Ironically, these are the very people, humanitarians, who advocated for the people of Gaza. Defying the myth of the open-air prisons, Gazans would actually leave Gaza and come here to work on the other side of the wall with these farmers, and then they'd go home at night. Kfar Azah, located about 5 kilometers east of Gaza, leverages the desert's diverse landscaping, ranging from rocky plateaus and sand dunes for its agricultural endeavors. The introduction of the modern drip system in the 1960s by an Israeli company called Netafirm played a crucial role in maximizing the use of scarce water resources, allowing Kfar Azah's farmers to cultivate their land effectively. Today, Israel recycles 90% of its sewer waters that's piped into this quiet area where these small farmers have created literally a breadbasket for the Middle East. Despite its serene appearances, Kfar Azah has faced its share of challenges. In recent years, the community has been targeted by rocket attacks from the Gaza Strips, creating a constant state of high alert and an emotional toll on its residents. Yet the community's determination to build their lives on this land remains unwavering. Supported by a variety of organizations, Kfar Azah continues to develop and strengthen, emphasizing the resilience and spirit of its inhabitants who chose to call this part of the Negev Desert their home. At 7 a.m. on October the 7th, 2023, sirens began warning local residents of what they thought was an incoming rocket attack. This was the Jewish holiday of Shemini Atzeret at the Supernova Sukkot Gathering, an open-air music festival near the kibbutz rim in Israel. Over 3,500 young people attended this event in the Negev Desert. The festival had been extended to the morning of October 7th, unfortunately. These young people had no idea that what they thought was bomb sirens would actually become the tragic scene of one of the most deadly attacks in Israel's history. With sirens warning of an incoming attack, armed militants dressed in military attire and using various modes of transportation, such as motorcycles, and trucks, and power paragliders, surrounded the festival grounds. Panic filled the concert as the unsuspecting concertgoers began to panic. They ran in all directions, but the militants indiscriminately fired on them, seeking refuge in nearby locations such as bomb shelters, bushes, and orchards, they continued to fall under attack. Many victims were shot in the back as they ran. Students who hid in garbage dumpsters were fired upon by militants who surrounded the dumpster. The militants executed and wounded individuals literally at point-blank range. The festival of unarmed teenagers was targeted by Hamas militants, and it resulted in the death of 364 civilians, with many more wounded, and at least 40 taken hostage. This attack is considered one of the worst civilian massacres in Israel history, and it's characterized by the sudden and high number of casualties. In a nearby community, another group of militants targeted the Serene farming community of Kfar Azzah. This farming community had a diverse population of local farmers. They supported Gazans, a small group of IDF soldiers, Gazan daily immigrants, and students. They all coexisted peacefully. This community, often associated with pacifists and supportive stance toward Gazans, were home to residents who chose to live close to the Gaza Strip, despite the ongoing tensions and violence in the regions. Now, their reasons varied from a belief in maintaining Israel's presence near the coastal enclave to affordable homes and areas, at least in comparison to other parts of Israel. In the early morning hours, this tranquility was shattered when farmers tending their farms heard the screeching of trucks filled with Hamas soldiers shooting their automatic weapons. The community, with about 400 unarmed residents, faced an unprecedented onslaught. Farmers literally defended their farms with knives and rocks as militants shot at them with their automatic weapons inside their canvas-covered farms. The attacks resulted in dozens of bodies. Amidst the destruction of burned-out homes, scattered belongings, and torched vehicles, the Israeli military undertook the grim task of removing the bodies, working through booby traps and still-active gunmen. The impact of the attack was deeply felt, turning an initial shock and disgust among the locals into anger and into a call for revenge. Not far from the farm was another coordinated attack in the kibbutz Be'er. In this picture, you can see the city of Gaza in the background, and the kibbutz farm in the fore. The militants entered the kibbutz using motorcycles and vehicles and proceeded to go from house to house, executing residents and setting the buildings on fire. Members of the kibbutz, including those with military training who formed a volunteer guard, they fought against the militants, but they were just overwhelmed. The kibbutz's security team, consisting of 10 members, engaged in a futile attempt to defend the community, and they suffered heavy casualties. At this location, the attacks resulted in the deaths of at least 130 people, including a significant portion of the farming community's residents. Among the victims were women and children and toddlers and an infant. The violence extended to the burning down of dozens of homes within the kibbutz. During the attack, up to 50 people were taken hostage in a dining room within Be'er, and others were kidnapped and taken to the Gaza Strip. Hostages included women, children, and senior citizens. Security forces eventually stormed the dining hall, freeing the hostages and killing the militants present. However, the aftermath of the attack, it left this community in devastation with significant loss of life and property. The attack on the kibbutz Be'er, the concert, and the small farming community was part of a coordinated series of assaults by Hamas and other militant groups across neighboring Israeli communities. Now, this was not a group of untrained terrorists. This was a group of highly trained militia making up over 4,000 soldiers. They were working on orders to eradicate the Jews. We'll show you in a moment that these soldiers were highly armed from the government of Gaza, supported by the larger superpowers of Iran. It took Israel Defense Forces 2 days to regain full control of the area. The massacre of Be'er, described by some as an act of terrorism, was a particularly shocking incident due to the scale of the casualties and the nature of the violence inflicted on the community. This attack on Kfar Azzah was part of a larger conflict that has had a staggering loss of life. The death toll reached at least 1,400 people, including a number of children and a larger number taken hostage. Additionally, over 5,000 people were wounded. The scale of this violence represents a significant moment in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it has deeply affected the communities involved, and it has reshaped the regional political dynamics. I can only say that these pictures can't really describe the horrors that we saw while we were there, the pain of the survivors, and the dedication of this country to eradicate what has happened here. So let's start with talking about what motivates the two sides. Let's start with Hamas. The motivation behind Hamas's attack on Israel on October the 7th, 2023 are multifaceted and they're complex. They have various interpretations and perspectives, contributing to the understanding of this significant event. Iran's involvement with Hamas is a key aspect of this scenario. Iran is known to fund, arm, and train Hamas. But its exact role in the October 7th attack remains a subject of debate. Despite its support for Hamas, Iran is predominantly a Shia Muslim country, and it's had its reservations due to Hamas's Sunni background. It has also been suggested that Iran may have had prior knowledge of the attack, but the exact details of this are still unclear. In fact, there seems to be some evidence they didn't know. Either way, this highlights a dynamic and at times uneasy relationship between Iran and Hamas, marked by strategic alignments as well as an underlying tension due to those sectarian differences. Hamas, according to Hamas officials, justified the attack as a response to Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people in Jerusalem and the West Bank, and they aimed to break the blockade on Gaza Strip. It's also been seen as a means to free thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. This aligns with Hamas's longstanding objectives in seeking revenge for perceived injustices, such as the 2021 clash at Al-Aqsa Mosque that injured 300 Muslims and 20 Israeli police. But Hamas's actions reflect a deep-seated opposition to Israel that is far beyond the immediate political and territorial disputes. Hamas's action also appear to be a strategic attempt to assert its relevance and leadership amongst Palestinians and to challenge rival factions within the Palestinian territories. They also believed that this would ignite the rest of the Arab world that would not only escalate the war, but overthrow the Jewish state. This attack cannot be simplified to a single motive or cause. It should be seen in a historical view of Hamas. Now, if you review the writings of Hamas leadership, it's really clear that the October 7th massacre was not about Israel oppression of Gaza. It's not about a two-state solution. And it's not about Palestine's right to do with their land as they wish. It's also not about Israeli settlements. I think you'll see by the writings and doctrines of Hamas that they wanted the land that Israel is on. And more importantly, they want all Zionists dead. Hamas hoped that the October 7th was the beginning of a second Holocaust, inspired by the religious ideals of jihadism, as opposed to a layered and intricate nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, influenced by regional politics, historical grievances, and the aspirations of various stakeholders within and outside of the Palestinian territories.
Moments later, he is more composed as he turns the camera on himself. He says his name and that he's 24 years old. He's a father. He says he killed two Israeli soldiers. He asks God for victory and well-deserved martyrdom. On motorbikes now, they keep advancing, moving together along empty Israeli roads, or nearly empty. The man cheers as he sees bodies on the road. His is not the first wave. He rounds a corner. Here, we have seen this place before, among the first videos to come out after the attack. This is dashcam video from a car on the same road moments earlier. The car approaches a group of militants who open fire. The car coasts, its driver almost certainly dead by now. It is just after 7:40 in the morning. After a quick reload, the group approaches a military base near the kibbutz of Re'im. For 65 minutes since crossing the Gaza fence, they have had nearly free rein in Israel. The gunman closes the distance with a weapon he took from an Israeli soldier, opening fire. And fire comes back. This man's part of the attack comes to an end. The terror is just beginning. Oren Lieberman, CNN, in Tel Aviv.
In 2006, Hamas emerged as a dominant force in Palestinian politics. It captured the largest number of seats in the Palestinian Authority's legislature. It surpassed Fatah and other secular parties. Now, this victory was pivotal, as Hamas was an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it's always been distinct in its ideology from the more secular, nationalistic stances of the PLO. Founded in 1987, Hamas firmly opposed the secular approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It instead advocated for an Islamic state over the entire area of what they considered to be the historical Palestine, also known as Israel. Most importantly, they endorsed violence and terrorism as a means to accomplish their end. The 1988 Hamas Covenant of Islamic Recovery Movement is foundational to its ideology. It called for a jihad against the Jews, drawing from a deeply anti-Semitic language that was echoed in the sentiments of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. This document, portrayed in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as part of an eternal struggle between Muslims and Jews, and it contained explicit calls for violence against Jews and the destruction of Zionist organizations, including non-political groups like the Freemasons and Rotary Club. This charter, by conflating Zionism with global control conspiracies, perpetuated an anti-Semitic stereotype that have been historically used to justify violence against the Jews. This is not just a passing document. It is foundational to who they are. In December 2012, long after the election, Khalid Mashal, the Hamas's leader in exile, reflected the traditional Hamas objective of the 1988 manifesto. He said, quote, "The state will come from resistance, not negotiation. Palestine is ours from the river to the sea and from the south to the north," he said in a speech. Now, note here how this comment is intended. This comment of "from the river to the sea" is about the eradication of all Jews from Israel. He went on to say further, quote, "There will be no concession of any inch of land. We will never recognize the legitimacy of the Israeli occupation. We will free all of Jerusalem, inch by inch, stone by stone. Israel has no right to be in Jerusalem," end quote. This reflects the same words of the covenant back in 1988, which is Gaza's constitution. It is filled with, quote, "The day of judgment will not come until Muslims fight the Jews, killing the Jews. Come and kill him," end quote. The government of Gaza and its covenants are filled with conspiracy theories that defy credibility, yet frames the psychopathy of their thinking. Now, this one sounds unbelievable, but the conspiracy theories have no logical limits, like Zionist organizations, quote, "like Freemasons, Rotary Clubs, and Lions Clubs will be obliterated," end quote. Look, this would be funny, except that it's actually a true representation of their thinking. It's almost comical to think in the grand scheme of international conspiracies, organizations like the Rotary Club and Lions Clubs would end up being named. These clubs, known for their community service and charity work, being cast as key players in a global plot, seems like the stuff of a dystopian novel. Imagine, if you will, a secret world-dominating meeting where agendas include community fundraisers, local charity events, an occasional pancake breakfast. It's like saying that your local bake sale is covertly plotting the world domination just one cupcake at a time. So a small tip here. I get a lot of cryptic comments about Zionism. This world means so many different things to different people. But the definition of Zionism simply means someone who wants to restore a homeland to the Jews. When you say that you like Jews but you hate Zionism, it's hard to see how someone hates the type of person who wants a homeland for Jews unless you hate Jews. What this statement really means is that you apply a set of conspiracy theories to Jews that are similar to those who started the Holocaust. Most Jews believe they have a right to a homeland after the Holocaust. But of course, it never stops there, such as in this document. It points out that the anti-Zionist is someone who buys into all this stuff about they want to control the world through their money. If you buy into all this conspiracy theory, like Zionism is the manipulator of the world, well, then that's actually textbook anti-Semitism. Now, if that's your goal, who am I to stop you? But for people who actually care to avoid racist statements, I just offer this one up to you. In 2017, the document of the general principles and policies designed to elicit media attention and soften the image of Hamas didn't refute the covenant that we spoke about earlier. In fact, it actually endorsed much of what was written in the manifesto. But they did have three important departures from the 1988 charter. Hamas, while offering counterstatements, seems to open up the establishment of a Palestinian state separate from Israel, although it's only provisional. Its statement on principles and policies said, quote, Hamas rejects any alternative to the full and complete liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, end quote, meaning that they'll accept a two-state solution so long as they can come back and conquer the rest later. They haven't come far from Arafat's action in Oslo. Second, they state that they're not anti-Semitic, they just hate Zionists. They try to distinguish between Jews or Judaism and modern Zionism. Zionists, those who want a homeland for Jews, are still aggressive, colonial, and expansionist, according to them. I guess, while they didn't reject the idea of killing Lions Clubs and Rotary members in this version, they thought it would help to try to distinguish between Jews and Zionists. Third, the document didn't reference the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. Again, this organization is who Hamas was originally an offshoot from. This was, I suspect, an olive branch to Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood has tried to overthrow the government. Now, those words that you see here are the words of the Hamas leader Ismaili Haniyeh on October the 7th. He said, quote, all Qassam brigades made the enemy lose its balance in just a few minutes with the grand and blessed incursion. With this epic presence of men who write history with their blood and guns, with their footsteps that crush the occupying invaders, and we say to all countries, including our beloved Arab nations, you must know that this entity which is incapable of protecting itself from our fighters is incapable of providing you with security or protection. All the normalization and recognition processes, all the agreements that have been signed with Israel can never put to an end this battle, end quotes. Further, Haniyeh's statement, laden with defiance, seemed to underscore the broader objectives of Hamas. Beyond immediately political or territorial gains, they reflected a continuation of Hamas's longstanding position against Israel even existing, and the pursuit of a final victory as envisioned by their foundational documents. Haniyeh's address also appears to be a response to the agreement that was being negotiated between the Biden administration, Israel, and Saudi Arabia as part of the Abraham Accords, positioning the October 7th attack as a pivotal moment in the Palestinian struggle against Israel, and to call to Arab nations to reassess their stance towards Israel. Now, it's worth the moment to point out how these two leaders that have been mentioned here do not live in Gaza. They amass considerable wealth while living in a luxury Qatar. Their combined net worth is estimated, the three of them here are worth over $11 billion. They enjoy a lavish lifestyle, staying in five-star hotels and traveling on private jets. Despite the hardships faced by Palestinians in Gaza, Hamas leaders, including Haniyeh, have not shied away from displaying their affluent lifestyles. Hamas's annual budget is around $2 billion. It's sourced from various channels, including taxes on goods entering Gaza and significant financial support from Iran, estimated at $250 million annually since 2014. Additionally, there are funds raised through donations and aid groups, with Qatar being a notable benefactor, transferring substantial sums to Hamas. Now, these leaders tell the people of Gaza that they are engaged in a liberation movement. But it seems to me like they're more involved in a luxurious lifestyle movement for themselves. Maybe they think they can do a better job to fight for Palestinian rights from the beachfront views and the comfort of their jacuzzis. So let's turn to what is Israel's objective. Benjamin Netanyahu says from the out front that it's this: to eliminate Hamas and free their hostages. It has to be pointed out these objectives may be counter to one another. The survival of the hostages and eliminating Hamas seem difficult to accomplish both. I'm not sure how Israel can allow these crimes to go unaddressed, and proposals that allow Hamas to stay in power seem analogous to Americans allowing Osama bin Laden to be in charge of Arab states after 9/11. It's not only unreasonable, I think it's a bad idea for humanity. The real question for Hamas is, will other Arab states come to the rescue? As stated, prior to 1967, Palestinian leadership created significant unrest through extreme ideologies in other Arab nations that they tried to make their homeland. It appears to me that there is a discernible difference between Palestinian groups, most notably in Gaza, and other Arab parties. An intriguing aspect of the conflict, particularly since October 7th, is a muted response from the broader Arab community. Notably, Saudi Arabia remains open to pursuing a peace agreement with Israel, and that's an indication of an interest in regional stability and diplomatic solutions. Similarly, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Bahrain have maintained diplomatic ties by not withdrawing their ambassadors, signaling a nuanced approach to the issue. Now, Jordan, which hosts a significant Palestinian population, constituting about half of its citizenry, did recall its ambassador, reflecting a unique demographic and political challenge related to the Palestinian issue. But the subdued reaction from these Arab states is revealing, and it may suggest that there's a shift in regional dynamics regarding the Palestinian cause. This response, or lack thereof, could indicate that the political priorities of these nations are evolving, with a growing emphasis on national interests, stability, and potentially normalization of relationships with Israel over a unified stance on Palestinian aspirations. I think it's a fair guess that besides the effect of 1967 and 1973 wars that solidified Israel's long-term position in the Middle East, that the possibility of extreme radical jihadist government in Gaza is threatening to other Arab nations that remember the turmoil that they caused when they were part of their countries. Regardless, this development underscores a complex and changing landscape in the Middle East geopolitics, where traditional alliances and enmities are increasingly influenced by programmatic considerations. There seems to be a handout to Israel. The question is, can Israel afford to take it? While we have currently the fog of war, maybe the real opportunity for a longer-term peace, and with little cost protecting the rules-based order, may be a real possibility in the Middle East. In our upcoming episode, titled Echoes of War, Jihadism and the American Divide, we'll delve into several complex and politically sensitive issues that Israel faces today. Our discussion will encompass a range of critical topics, including the characterization of Israel as a colonial power, the debate over whether Israel's military responses adhere to the principles of proportionality, the assertion that Israel's treatment of Hamas and its action in Gaza constitute the fundamental causes of the ongoing conflict, the allegations labeling Israel as part of an apartheid state, the impact that these issues have on the social and political divisions here in the United States. And lastly, we're going to try to explore the potential pathways for peace, including the feasibility of a two-state solution. Now, thank you for tuning in. I'm Paul Johnson. I'm inviting you to engage with our content by subscribing to our channel and by leaving your comments. Your support enables us to continue providing in-depth analysis on these important topics.
And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. It holds out the promise of more sacrifice instead of more security. The new frontier is here.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.